America will stop me and take all my reserves from me. No, it is better not to do this. And they are de-dollarizing their reserves. There are many countries that willingly de-dollarize their resources gradually without creating a monetary shock. And many more countries are planning to do this. Having less dollars means having less demand for dollars. Less demand for dollars means less production of dollars. Less production of dollars means that the U.S. debt cannot be paid.
Por la deuda de los Estados Unidos, la cara de impagable.
Gracias, Fabrizio. Desgraciadamente.
Thank you, Fabrizio. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of the program. Thank you very much for your participation. This is Black and White.
Muchas gracias.
De nada. Adiós.
Adiós.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Opening arguments began on Monday morning, 22nd of April, in Donald Trump's historic hush money trial. Trump, who seemed to doze off, was woken up when a prosecutor called him a liar. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump is on trial in New York City, where he is facing felony charges relating to a 2016 hush money payment to a film actress Stormy Daniels. It marks the first time in history that a former U.S. president has been tried on criminal charges. Donald Trump last April pleaded not guilty to a 34-count indictment charging him with falsifying business records to hide the reimbursement of a hush money payment his then-attorney Michael Cohen made to Stormy Daniels in order to boost his electoral prospects in the 2016 presidential election. Prosecutors have called former American Media Inc. executive David Pecker as their first witness in the trial. The district attorney alleges that David Pecker, who oversaw the National Enquirer, engaged in a conspiracy with Donald Trump and Trump's then-attorney Michael Cohen to help influence the 2016 election by killing negative stories about Trump. David Pecker, who once called Donald Trump a personal friend of mine, flashed a big smile as he took the stand as the trial's first witness, belying the gravity of the moment. Pecker, 72 years old, was the publisher of the National Enquirer, but prosecutors said he was acting as a co-conspirator in helping buy and bury damaging stories about Donald Trump. Trump, who once said Pecker would make a brilliant choice as editor of Time magazine, listened while leaning forward in his chair, arms crossed on the table, an unhappy look on his face. David Pecker testified that he had final say whether to publish any story involving a famous person. I had the final say of the celebrity side of the magazine, Pecker said. We used checkbook journalism. We paid for the stories. David Pecker is testifying pursuant to a subpoena. he has also secured a non-prosecution agreement with the Manhattan District Attorney's office. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's defense attorney, Todd Blanche, in his opening statement said, "Donald Trump is not just our former president. He's not just Donald Trump that you've seen on television. He's also a man. He's a husband and a father." Todd Blanche pushed back on the district attorney's overall allegation that the payments to Trump's attorney Michael Cohen weren't only payback for Stormy Daniels by using the prosecutor's own words against him. Todd Blanche noted that Michael Cohen paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels, but that Donald Trump paid back Cohen a total of $420,000. If Trump really was a frugal businessman, as prosecutors claim, why would he overpay that money? Todd Blanche asked. Ask yourself, would a frugal businessman, a man who pinched his pennies, repay a $130,000 debt to the tune of $420,000? Blanche asked. Todd Blanche repeatedly reiterated that Michael Cohen truly was an attorney for Trump and was doing legal work for him, pointing out that Michael Cohen's own email signature noted he was Trump's attorney. None of this was a crime, Todd Blanche said, saying the 34 counts against Donald Trump are really just 34 pieces of paper. The American newspaper, The Daily Beast, has also covered the same story. Opening statements had not yet begun on Monday, 22nd of April, when former President Donald Trump dozed off for the first time. He quickly opened his eyes when defense attorney Todd Blanche slid him a note as prosecutors prepared to kick off opening arguments in the historic trial, which hinges on accusations that the former president falsified business records over a $130,000 hush money payment to film actress Stormy Daniels in an effort to keep her quiet as the 2016 presidential election loomed. The trial marks the only time in American history that a former commander-in-chief has been tried on criminal charges. If convicted, Donald Trump could face up to 4 years behind bars. "You must decide this case on the evidence," Judge Juan Merchan instructed the jury. Donald Trump's eyes appeared to close again as Judge Merchan continued laying out the ground rules to the five women and seven men from various parts of Manhattan who were seated as jurors last week, along with six alternates who were also present in the jury box. The first day of proceedings gave both sides an opportunity to offer their initial arguments to the jury, who paid rapt attention even as the 45th president looked as if he'd rather be anywhere else. Prosecutors called their first witness, former tabloid king David Pecker, who took the stand to describe how checkbook journalism worked in this case. Reporters were under strict instructions from Judge Juan Merchan not to be too descriptive about the members of the jury, so as not to make them easily identifiable to the public and to protect their safety outside of the courtroom. Assistant District Attorney Matthew Colangelo kicked off opening arguments laying out the prosecution's case against Donald Trump, accusing him of orchestrating a criminal scheme that would corrupt the 2016 presidential election. "This case is about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up," Matthew Colangelo said, arguing that he lied over and over again. He said Donald Trump, Michael Cohen, and National Enquirer boss David Pecker formed a conspiracy to silence film actress Stormy Daniels. All in all, the defendant distinguished his reimbursements to Michael Cohen by a way of falsifying checks and ledger entries that amounted to a criminal scheme, Matthew Colangelo argued. Colangelo added, "Then he covered up that criminal conspiracy by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again," Colangelo said. Donald Trump also launched a conspiracy with David Pecker, who took direction from Trump to bury negative stories about him while slamming his opponents, including Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, who was also vying for the GOP presidential nomination at the time. This, Colangelo told the jury, is called catch and kill. Donald Trump and David Pecker and Michael Cohen carried out three different catch-and-kill deals to help him get elected. The schemes involved the candidate's fixer actively colluding with a media enterprise to keep negative information from coming out before the 2016 presidential election.
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses, and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains, and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said, let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Aria. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. Nonetheless important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems, such as steel laser cutters, are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, this company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff, who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. But you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult. Maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it would be even more difficult to do that. Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750 and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes, and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain, and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean. The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout, but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis, to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off, they disassemble all of the spokes on the rim, they reinstall it on the electric motor. But there's a crucial step here.
They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached, as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufacture power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
This is the last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears. But then there is display, and with this number that shows a assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Well, that covers today's Bazaar. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and my guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Salaam alaikum, and welcome to the program again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, like before, we are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But this time, we are going to actually devote a couple of sessions to the rules about mosque. So, Sheikh, let's start with this general question regarding mosques, or basically offering prayers in the mosque. We all know that the mosques, in fact, hold a special place in the minds of all Muslims, right? Yes. It's like the church. Maybe it is not even similar to the concept of the church for Christians.
Sure.
Because Christians usually, go to the church on Sundays. They don't go there every day. But the mosques are not like this for Muslims. They not only go there every day, but a couple of times a day, right?
Yes,
to offer the prayer with the imam, with somebody who's leading the other Muslims in the prayers. So would you tell our dear audience about the importance of this, and how important is it for the individuals to basically say their prayers in the mosques rather than individually?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, great emphasis has been laid on offering prayers in mosques. And indeed, mosques are different from in terms of the amount of sawab that you might achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on which mosque you perform your prayers, is it, for example, Masjid al-Haram or Masjid al-Nabi or Masjid Kufa or Masjid al-Aqsa, or your local mosque, or maybe the central mosque in your city?
Yes.
So, of course, the Masjid al-Haram, there's no doubt as to the fact that it is superior to all other mosques. It is the most important mosque. And then comes Masjid al-Nabi, which is the next most important mosque in the Islamic world. And then, of course, we have Masjid Kufa, which is also very well known, especially for the Shias, because Shia Muslims who go to Kufa, they perform their prayers in that mosque.
Yes.
Because of the tremendous sawab that it has, it you earn praying in that mosque. Of course, there's no doubt that if you offer your prayers in Jama'ah, then if all the trees become pain and all the ocean turns into ink,
yes,
and the sawab, the reward cannot be written, cannot be recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we have the Masjid Jami in your city. Every city has a central mosque.
Yes,
of course the sawab,
like a cathedral.
Yes, the sawab in of the prayer offered in Masjid Jame or the central mosque is more compared to the sawab of the masjid of the prayer offered in a local mosque.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that in this time around, of course, unfortunately, we have very few people going to the mosques. And there are hadith traditions from our infallible imams. For example, Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam says, "Thalathatun yashkuna ila Allah azza wa jal." Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Masjidun kharabun la yusalli fihi ahlu. One of the things which complain to Allah Almighty is the mosque, in which the people in the neighborhood where the mosque is situated do not go to offer their prayers in the mosque. On the day of resurrection, one of the things which complain to Allah Almighty is the mosque.
Mm.
Okay, I was there, but no one was coming to me to offer their prayers. Okay, and then there is alimun bayn al-juhal. And alimun bayn al-juhal, that the knowledgeable person living among the ignorant people, they do not go to the alim to ask their questions, religious questions, theological questions. And then, mushafun mu'allakun qad waqa alayhi al-ghubar. And then the Holy Quran, which is, for example, placed on the shelves of your house, and it is there, but it's collecting dust. Okay, so these are the three things which, according to Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, which will complain to Allah Almighty on the day of judgment for not being attended.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yes.
Okay, let me stop you there actually for a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program after the short break. You're listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jobid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the general jurisprudential rules regarding praying in the mosque with Sheikh. Sheikh, you were saying?
Yeah, that was my point. And of course, it is very important for a Muslim individual who is adherent, who is a practicing Muslim, to leave the comfort of his house or the couch he sits and go to the mosque.
Yes.
And of course offer his prayers in the mosque. It is not only in the person offering his prayers in the mosque not only earn the reward for praying, but he also respects the mosque. And of course, وَمَن يُعَظِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِن تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ. So one of the signs of God is definitely the mosque. The verse says that whoever builds a mosque, or you see, revives the mosque, it is a sign of iman. You see, it's not only building a mosque does not mean only constructing it. A person who keeps a mosque alive and keeps it moving, acting, visiting the mosque, and the mosque is always remains with visitors, then of course it is a sign of iman in the day of in God and also in the day of judgment.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. Hosting this program, Asha Chavidar, guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to offering prayers in the mosque based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh, there is a question, especially we Shias face that, what about the shrines of the imams? Are they considered as mosques, or they need to be actually some kind of pronunciation of some formula for them to be actually considered as mosques? I mean, lots of Muslims, especially from the Shiite school of thought, they go to the shrines and they offer the prayers there, right?
Yes, of course.
So do they hold the same status as the mosques?
Obviously, the namaz or prayer in the shrines of the holy imams is mustahab. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, of course, the reward is much more than offering your prayer in a mosque. For example, it has been reported that the reward for offering prayers in a sacred shrine like the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salatu wasalam, is 200,000. Okay, mm-hmm. If you offer one rakat, it is as if you have offered 200,000 rakas.
Right.
So the reward is tremendous. Mm-hmm. But of course, the shrine is not treated as a mosque because they are two different things. Okay. Mm-hmm. For example, you can enter the premises of the holy shrine, mm-hmm. the holy shrine, but you cannot enter a mosque and stay there or sit there or leave there, put something there, pick something up from the mosque. But these are the things you can do in a shrine, okay? Mm-hmm. You can enter the shrine, you can enter the for example the corridors or the porch, and then but you cannot get close to the chamber, okay?
Right.
Especially when it comes to ladies who are menstruating, mm-hmm. Of course they should not get close to the zarih or the chamber,
right?
As they say.
Okay. What about the yard, for example, of the mosque? I mean.
Yeah, depending on where the formula of the mosque has, the mosque applies, okay? If it is part of the mosque and it is considered to be part of the mosque, so the formula applies to it. Uh-huh. And it is considered to be mosque. And, of course, the rules which are applied to the mosque, which is believed to be the mosque, the main part of the mosque, is also applicable to that part of the mosque which
I
are
see.
Yes.
A very quick question, Sheikh, to the end of the program. We don't have much time. What's actually better for a woman to do, like to offer her prayers in a mosque or in her own home?
Well, for women, it is better to pray at such places where they are best protected from non-mahram, from strangers, from people who are considered to be non-mahram, of course, because it's important for the woman to observe their hijab, to dress properly, and it does not make any difference where they can better, of course, observe their hijab. Whether they can observe their hijab at home or in a mosque. And of course, they will earn the sawab, the reward for offering their prayers in a mosque. But hijab is much more important than offering your prayer in a place where you are exposed mm-hmm. to the eyes of non-mahram. For example, especially if women offer their prayers in public places, in open places where men who are not related to the woman, pass by, they see the woman, and maybe sometimes there is wind flying, you see, blowing against the woman's well, and maybe part of her hair or maybe neck or legs might become visible. In this case, of course, there is such probability, it is much better for her to perform her prayers in her home, mm-hmm, rather than coming out to the mosque and offering her prayers in places where she is not protected.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to offering prayers in a mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Reminding the U.S. of the Tabas miracle. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Greetings to our listeners on the anniversary of a modern-day miracle that proved to the world how God Almighty protects those striving in His path for justice from the stratagems of the evil powers. It is a day of thanksgiving for the Iranian people, since it was on this day in 1980 when God empowered the sands of the desert region of Tabas in northeastern Iran to shatter the military of the United States, when the arrogantly ignorant Great Satan launched a well-planned invasion of the newly founded Islamic Republic of Iran in the hope of kidnapping or killing its senior leaders and freeing from captivity the 50-odd American spies detained for the crimes against humanity. Consequently, the 25th of April is a constant reminder to all would-be aggressors of the divine wrath awaiting them if they are fool enough to try attack a nation adhering to the dynamic teachings of Islam, as bequeathed by the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, and as rationally propounded by the infallible imams of his blessed household, peace be upon them. The coincidence this year of the 37th anniversary of the American debacle at Tabas with the day of Mab'ath is an excellent omen for the Islamic Republic and its goals and aspirations in the region in defense of the oppressed people. In view of the fact that on the 27th of Rajab, truth prevailed with the formal appointment to prophethood of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Stay with us for an exclusive feature in this regard. God Almighty says in Ayah 53 of Surah Fussilat in the Holy Quran, "Soon we shall show them our signs in the horizons and in their own souls until it becomes clear to them that He is the real." Is it not sufficient that your Lord is witness to all things? The 25th of April is the anniversary of one of those memorable days when God Almighty showed a glimpse of His signs when He decreed particles of sand to rise as high as 10,000 feet in the air in the form of a dense white cloud, swirling, whirling and twirling around an airborne US invasion force which had stealthily descended upon a remote strip in the Iranian desert near the town of Tabaz in the dead of night for a surprise assault on Tehran, where with the help of turncoat Iranians, they would kill senior revolutionary leaders, overthrow the Islamic Republic, and free the 52 American spies detained by students following the path of the father of the Islamic Revolution, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. The next morning, however, as an unaware Iranian nation woke up, it was a pleasant surprise to learn of the miracle in Tabaz. A miracle had forced America's elite force to flee Iran with the remnants of helicopters and planes, leaving behind the charred bodies of several dead soldiers and wreckage of seven helicopters and a C-130 Hercules transport aircraft that had crashed into each other thanks to the sandstorm. Officials and the general public prostrated to God Almighty in thanksgiving for saving the Islamic Republic from an elaborately hatched plot of the Great Satan, which was in contact with anti-revolutionaries in government circles and had made sure that Delta Force would undergo intense training in similar conditions in the United States, also in Egypt and Oman, for the precisely planned operation codenamed Eagle Claw. As God Almighty says in Ayah 54 of Surah Ali Imran, "They planned and God planned, and certainly God is the best of planners." Without the least doubt, the adherence of the Iranian Muslims to the Holy Quran, to Sharia of the Prophet of Islam, and to the teachings of the Immaculate Ahlul Bayt or the Holy Prophet's household, peace be upon them, in establishment of the Islamic government, as well as their constant prayers, God, to safeguard the sacred system, especially the invocations of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, peace be upon him, the Holy Prophet's eighth infallible heir, to intercede in the divine court, were immediately answered by the Creator of the universe, who is witness over all things. When US invasion force that night tried to kidnap 44 pilgrims bound from Mashhad and traversing through that remote area, the nose of the arrogantly ignorant United States was again rubbed in the dust. Today, 37 years later, when much water has flowed under the bridges and Uncle Sam has agreed to a seemingly workable nuclear accord after seeing failure after failure of its plots against the Islamic Republic of Iran, including the 8-year war it had imposed on Iran through Saddam, the assassination of several senior officials by the MKO, and the yet-to-be-completely-lifted illegal sanctions, the questions that arise are, has Washington learned from its past mistakes? And can Iran trust the United States? The answer to both of those questions is a big no. The hyena cannot change whatever it has got of stripes. By nature, it is a scavenger, devoid of any courage and integrity. It means the moment Iran drops its guard, the rapacious beast would attack. It is in view of these facts that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has cautioned Iranian officials against being duped by the United States. The leader recently said that neither the United States nor a more evil power can do any harm to the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is clear by America's behavior in arming to the hilt Arab reactionary regimes in this region, America's military presence in the Middle East and Persian Gulf region, continued support for crimes against humanity being committed by the illegal Zionist regime, America's destabilization of Syria and Iraq through the godless Takfiri terrorists, and instructions to the Wahhabi minority regime of Riyadh to bomb the hapless people of Yemen for the past 2 years. America's lawlessness warrants that Iran should spare no effort in strengthening its defenses, including the range of precision and precision of its missiles, and complete trust in God Almighty that he will never let down a grateful Sharia-abiding nation. What, have you not seen how your Lord dealt with the hordes of the elephant? Did he not cause their stratagems to go awry, and send against them flocks of birds, pelting them with stones of shale, thus making them like chewed-up straws?